funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., this is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. You have to be really sparing with the word legendary if you want to maintain journalistic credibility, but I don't hesitate to use it to describe Diane Rehm. In 2013, President Obama presented her with the National Humanities Medal, praising her keen insights and boundless curiosity. She has interviewed heads of state, thought leaders, journalists, novelists, and artists. Her workdays start early and end late, and at 79, she's only just begun to think about retirement. Over the past few years, she has also faced what may have been the greatest personal challenge of her life, watching the long decline of her husband of 54 years, knowing he was ready to die but unable to help him take his own life, and beginning to build a life without him after his death in 2014. Last Friday, I sat down with Diane at WAMU, where the Diane Rehm Show has been produced since 1984. Diane, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
It should surprise nobody that you and your late husband, John Rehm, first bonded over books.
Isn't that funny? He walked into the office where I was working as a secretary at the Department of State, and on my desk were three books. He's always remembered those books. The Essays of Alfred North Whitehead, Somerset Maugham's of Human Bondage, and The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. And I think he was somewhat surprised to see a secretary with those books on her desk. But the point was that I really felt intellectually surrounded by people who were just so smart and just knew so much. I had never gone to college. So somehow I wanted to educate myself, and it struck me that at least as a start, those books might help.
I don't normally ask people about their first kiss, but you have such a lovely story in the book.
We had gone on a drive and gone out to Virginia to the home of George Mason. And we were in the gardens there at the home of George Mason. And it was just lovely. It was so perfect and perfect setting. Nobody around, just walking through this maze of shrubbery seemed like a perfect day, perfect way to start a love story.
It was a love story that involved people who were very different. You and John were really different people.
Totally different. For one thing, as I've already said, I was not educated past high school. John went to Friend Seminary in New York for his prep school, then went to on scholarship, then went to Harvard on scholarship, Columbia Law School on scholarship. He was an extremely gifted man intellectually. He became my teacher in many, many ways. As a matter of fact, the very first day I volunteered here at WAMU as a total, you know, the only thing I knew about radio at the time was that I had listened to it all my life. But I came home that day so excited and so uplifted. And John Rehm said to me, "Someday you will be the host of that program." And I said, "Oh, for heaven's sake, that is just ridiculous. And here I am just starting out as a volunteer. Don't put that kind of pressure on me. Don't make those kinds of statements." But in fact, John Rehm always dreamed for me. And he did, in fact, see ahead. And here I am.
he had a confidence in your brilliance that you didn't have at the time.
He had a confidence in my ability to accomplish whatever I chose. In fact, he is the first person who ever said exactly those words to me. You can accomplish whatever you want. My parents had come to this country, my father from Beirut, my mother from Alexandria, Egypt, and as the daughter, of course I was born here in Washington, but as the daughter of Arab immigrants, they had no ambition for me beyond getting a job as a secretary. And so when John Rehm said to me, you can do anything you want, I mean, it seemed such an alien statement out of my ability to really understand what he meant.
It's evident how much you deeply loved each other, but I really admired your candor in not remembering your life together as one that was perfect every moment, or and not remembering your late husband, as so many people do when they've lost someone dear, as a perfect human being.
Well, to begin with, there are no perfect people, and there are no perfect marriages. And what I wanted to demonstrate with those very personal statements was that here we were in a marriage that lasted 54 years with times of great joy, with two wonderful children who had some very, very difficult times to get through, that is, John and I, and to demonstrate that, you know, despite those kinds of difficulties, we can make a marriage that is so worthwhile and so mutually supportive that my life now feels as though it has been worthwhile, and my marriage feels as though it was something so strong and so worthwhile. We had therapists along the way, each of whom would say, there is you, Diane, there is you, John, and then there is the marriage. The marriage is something separate and apart from the two of you. But you must work together to make that marriage a success. And I do regard our marriage as a great success, despite exactly, as you say, we were just such different people.
How did the way you talked to each other, the things you said to each other, change when you both understood that the time that you had left together was limited?
Oh, my goodness. Changed so much. I think that there were moments of such intimate conversations. You know, John was very much unto himself. He didn't need people around him, whereas I am precisely the opposite. I love being with people. I love to socialize. I love to have dinner with people. And John at one point said to me that he would rather have lunch with the New Yorker than any other human being.
With the magazine.
With the magazine, the New Yorker magazine. And I knew that that included me. But the point was when we learned that he was so ill and when he had moved into assisted living, we began to talk about the time wasted in arguments, in silences, in staying apart, even within our home, staying apart. And the sadness crept into our conversation, but 5 minutes later, we'd be talking about a fun time we had had, how we used to take our children, all our friends, down to the beach, how there'd be 20 people in the apartment sleeping all over the floor, and how he would be at the toaster while I was making fried eggs for everybody. I mean, marriage is a mixture of memories, a mixture of wonderful moments, and a mixture of sad moments.
You pose a question in the book that you don't answer, perhaps it has no answer, but it's something that I thought about a lot myself, and that is it better to lose someone knowing that your time is growing short, or is it better to have it happen suddenly, but there's no warning, but the person is able to sort of live fully until the moment their life ends? Have you ended up with an answer?
No. I think that losing John as I did, watching him deteriorate from Parkinson's disease, watching him lose that beautiful strength of body. When he and I met, he was about 6 feet tall, weighed about 180 pounds, and had wonderful, strong shoulders. He looked like a football player.
I've seen pictures. He was very handsome.
He really was. He, with a sweetness in that face that everyone recognized, but he had worked in his father's rock quarry on our farm property, and these shoulders were just dynamic and created this. I can remember walking behind him down the halls at the State Department and thinking, he must have played football. In fact, he rode for a while at Harvard, but then gave it up because it took too much time from his studies. But the time that we spent together talking about those memories, the time watching him lose his abilities, very difficult. Whereas, on the other hand, my darling friend of 45 years, to whom I talked every day, my friend Jane Dixon, died totally unexpectedly on Christmas night, just 2 months after John had gone into assisted living. So it was kind of a double blow, losing him because he had to move out of the apartment, and then losing her when she had just had a wonderful family party. And then on Christmas morning, I get the telephone call from her daughter that she is gone.
We're speaking this hour with Diane Rehm, host of The Diane Rehm Show. You can join in the conversation on Twitter by following me at Chris Boyd Think. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking today with Diane Rehm in the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. Her latest book is On My Own. And while we're not live this hour, you can join the conversation on Twitter by following me at Chris Boyd Think. Diane, talk about how you and John made the decision that he would move to an assisted living facility when you could no longer provide the kind of care he needed at home.
It was difficult, to say the least. Neither one of us wanted to go into assisted living. And we had talked earlier when we were both in good health, saying, you know, that's not something we want to do. However, as John's condition deteriorated, first we moved from our home of 40 years, which had many flights of stairs, because we were afraid he would fall, and then moved into our condo. And once we moved into the condo, he was able to continue to carry on his volunteer activities as a docent at the Freer and Sackler Galleries, reading for the blind, and volunteering at the Washington Home and Hospice. But then he had a back operation because his back was just deteriorating badly. Once that back operation took place, he was upright for about 1 year, and then slowly, slowly, the back began to take its toll, as well as Parkinson's taking its toll. He began to have imbalance. His tremor became worse, and he had 3 automobile accidents within a period of 18 months. And at first he said, well, you know, I'm fine. But then the insurance stopped. Mm. When you have 3 accidents within 18 months, the insurance company says, that's it. So John said, well, let's just find another insurance company. And I said, I think we better have you tested first. And that's when we found out he did have Parkinson's, because even in the driver's test, he was on the wrong side mm-hmm. of the road. He said he actually felt relieved not to drive anymore. But as Parkinson's worsened, John would leave the gas on the stove, or he might leave the front door open, or walking our dog Maxie, he might step out into the street when he shouldn't be. So then it became difficult for him to prepare his own lunch. And then it became impossible for him to get his clothes on. So we hired a caregiver within the apartment, and she's lovely. And I still keep in touch with Patience, whose name absolutely
suits the perfect name for someone in that profession.
Her personality just beautifully. She took care of John. She would arrive at 8 o'clock in the morning and stay until I came home about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then I would take care of fixing dinner and helping John get to bed. And then one night I woke up, not knowing why I woke up, and I found John sprawled in front of the bathroom. And I don't know if you've ever tried to lift someone who cannot help you lift him. It took an hour just to get him onto his knees and then to drag him back to his bed and then little by little get him up on the bed. I think we both knew that night that we'd have to do something radically different. The apartment was not large enough to hold someone there 24 hours a day for John. And so we began looking for a nearby resident facility and assisted living, and found one just 10, 15 minutes away. He wasn't happy at first when he moved in, but gradually he adjusted. But also gradually he began to lose even the ability to walk. And by the time John made his decision not to go on living, it was about a year and a half later.
You have spoken very candidly about how upsetting it was for you both to discover when that moment came that no one would help him end his life.
He was in an assisted living facility in Maryland. His doctor was very kind and understanding and had treated John with great care. At one point when I was down in Buenos Aires, John contracted pneumonia, and at 9 o'clock at night, our doctor, Roy Freed, went out to the drugstore to get an injectable form of antibiotic. Otherwise, John would have died that very night. And I know Dr. Freed did not want that to happen for my sake as much as for John's, because I wasn't there. However, it reached the point where the future seemed inevitable, as it is for all of us. But my husband asked that our son David come down from Gettysburg, where he is a professor of philosophy at Mount St. Mary's University. He asked that our daughter, Jennifer, a physician, be on the phone from Boston. He asked that our doctor be in the room, and I. And when we were all gathered, he simply said, "I am ready to die. Will you help me to the doctor?" And Dr. Freed understandably said, "John, I totally understand your feeling, but ethically, morally, legally, here in the state of Maryland, I cannot help you." And John, I think, totally misunderstood the situation and thought that he could simply be put to sleep. And Dr. Freed said, "I cannot do that." And John said, "Look, I can no longer feed myself. I can no longer walk from here to the bathroom. I can no longer bathe myself or care for myself in any way. And I have already felt as though I have fallen into degradation because of my helplessness. And I refuse to continue to live." And my daughter, the doctor, said, "But Dad, we can keep you comfortable." And John Rame said, "I don't want comfort. I am ready to die. And at that point, Dr. Fried said to him, the only thing that you, John Rehm, can do for yourself is to stop eating, stop taking medication, and stop drinking water. It is the lack of water that breaks down the organs almost immediately, starting after you cease taking water. You can go for a long time without food, but not without water. So we all left. And the next day, I came back to his room with a photograph album I had made for him years before of his years from childhood, birth in Paris, where he lived for 6 years all the way through Friends Seminary. And I got on the bed with him and put my arms around him, and I said, you look so well today. And he said, it's because I haven't had any water, I haven't had any food, I haven't had any medication. I have decided. And I said, sweetheart, are you sure that this is what you want? He said, absolutely. And my thought, Chris, is that the reason he looked so well was that he had taken his own life back into his own hands. He was once again in the place of authority regarding his own life. It took 10 days.
Did you ever consider, did it cross your mind to break the law, to obtain some kind of medication that could have helped him die immediately?
Do you know that when John and I first got to Brighton Gardens and first met Dr. Fried, Dr. Fried said to me and to John, but primarily to me, he said, Diane, this is going to be hard for you both, but I beg you, do not take any action on your own that would hasten John's death. He said, you're a public figure, and you must not do anything that would be in any way suspicious. And John understood that, and I understood that. I have talked to so many people who would have thought that they might be able to put a pillow over someone's head or perhaps obtain morphine or something. But I knew I could not do that. And really, I don't think I could ever have brought myself to do that, even if John had begged me.
What did it take for you to accept his decision to end his life by stopping nutrition and hydration? Because it can't be easy. It can't be easy to know that he's ready to go.
I had watched his decline for so many years. It made me so sad for him and for me. I missed the man that was. I missed the man who had such a positive outlook, who saw the good in so many people, who saw the good in life, but had now reached a point where the only time I saw him laugh or smile was when I walked in the door at Brighton Gardens. And, you know, he would talk about my clothes and he would talk about what I was doing and where I was going. And that seemed to make him happy and yet at the same time make him sad. I mean, I knew that if he wanted to go, all I could do would be there to be by his side, to understand that he had to make his own decision. I wouldn't have dreamed of trying to talk him out of it.
Now the memories that were yours as a couple and only yours, that first kiss, the day your children were born, those live only with you.
Oh, I have many more memories. I have so many memories of, you know, the first formal we went to. John was the, he rose high up in the State Department and then became the first general counsel to the Office of the Special Trade Representative. So we were invited to all kinds of Washington embassy and high-level affairs. And I even have photographs of that first gown I bought. We were going to a black tie event at the Belgian embassy here in Washington. And John looked so handsome in his brand new dinner jacket. And, you know, I have memories of him as a younger man, as a healthy person, of his breaking up with a pick the driveway in front of the house we lived in for 40 years.
We'll take a break now from our special conversation with Diane Rehm. We're talking about her new book, On My Own. We'll be back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes, and you can join it on Twitter by following me at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking today with Diane Rehm on her own turf, the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. Her latest book is On My Own, and while we're not live this hour, you can join the conversation on Twitter by following me at Chris Boyd Think. Diane, are we sitting in the studio where you normally do the show, or is this a separate facility?
Separate facility. Our studio is downstairs, right on Connecticut Avenue, so that people walking by can look in if they like. At one point, Dr. Oliver Sacks, who so sadly died recently, he and I were sitting facing each other, and all of a sudden, a group of nursery school children with their teachers gathered outside the window, and Dr. Sachs said at that moment, oh, how delightful. He said, you know, I once really seriously considered becoming a pediatrician. So seeing these young, bright faces is such a wonderful thing.
It's interesting to imagine him with that alternative career because you can see it 100%.
Absolutely. He had a way of empathizing, of connecting with people, despite his extraordinary shyness, and he was a very shy man.
So you mentioned earlier, and a lot of people know that you started as a volunteer. What did you actually do in that first volunteer? What were your responsibilities?
Well, my responsibilities were supposed to be to help the host find guests, choose topics, prepare questions, but Irma Andahl, who was the host, also invited those who had prepared the script, the other volunteers as well, to be in the studio with her. But the first day I came to volunteer, I was met at the door by someone I'm sure you're familiar with, Susan Harmon, who was the former manager of WAMU. Then she went on to KERA, your home station. And she met me at the door and said, I have sad news. The host is out sick. So I thought she was going to send me back home. Instead, she said, so I, Susan Harmon, am going to host the show, and I'd like you to come into the studio with me. First day as a volunteer. And we interviewed a representative of the Dairy Council for 90 minutes, Chris.
Wow, that is baptism by fire.
Truly, truly.
You know, I have to tell you, I think a lot of people hear your voice and are so fond of it, not only because they know who you are, but they've heard it every day for decades. I know it's not the voice that you were born with because of spasmodic dysphonia. The courage with which you have handled that is impressive to me, not only because it's physically difficult and you've had to work so hard, but because you have to let go of any vanity that you have about your voice to keep doing this work that you clearly were put on this earth to do.
Thank you for saying that. You know, I've never thought of it as courage. I've thought of it as stubbornness and the desire to continue. You know, when it first happened in February of 1998, I really did think my career was over. And I sat at home for 4 months, not answering the phone, not going out of the house except for walks in the neighborhood, not even to the drugstore because I couldn't get a word out. It was terrible. Finally, our internist got me to Johns Hopkins, and, you know, I had been to doctor after doctor after, and they all said it was in my head.
Did that make you furious?
Looking back, I wasted, because it started in 1992, and it was 1998 when I finally got the diagnosis in 1 hour that it was spasmodic dysphonia. Coincidentally, the same neurologist who identified this as spasmodic dysphonia, along with my otolaryngologist, Paul Flint, the neurologist was the same one who diagnosed John with Parkinson's disease. So after that 4 months, after I got to Johns Hopkins, after they had diagnosed it, they gave me my first injection right into the vocal cords of Botox, which temporarily paralyzes the vocal cords. So all you can do is whisper because the vocal cords are wide open. And so after I got that first injection and I had no voice, I had to talk directly into John's ear with a whisper so he could hear me. And he said it was the most intimate time of our lives.
I guess there's a silver lining to a lot
of
things.
Yes, exactly.
Have you ever tried to count how many interviews you have done in your career?
No. 37 years, 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. If you can do the math, good for you. I've never tried, you know, because there are times when we have four people in the studio. Other times, maybe one person. But most of our first hours are on topics that need multiple views. And so that's why I've never even tried to count.
I know there are a number of people that you've had on many times. Have there been people that you said, never again?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Tom Clancy was one.
Why?
Because he came in shortly after his first book was published, and it was way, way popular. It was out of this world. And he came in wearing aviator glasses, dark aviator glasses, never took his sunglasses off, wouldn't even shake my hand when he walked into the studio. And I thought he was going to take his glasses off when we got into the studio. Instead, he put his elbow on the table and covered his eyes with his hand that way. So I'm thinking, oh, dear, I wonder what this is going to be like. So I give him a first really good question because I've read the book carefully. And his first answer is, yep.
Oh, no. It's that moment of panic, right? It's live. What are you going to do for an hour?
Ask him another question. Second answer, nope. So I had two choices. I could either say to him, Mr. Clancy, it's clear you'd rather not be here, so why don't you just go? I'll open the phones. Or maybe he doesn't like me as a woman. Maybe he doesn't want to be interviewed by me. I'll just open the phones, and maybe he'd rather talk to listeners. Thank goodness I chose the second road. I open the phones. First caller, a man who begins by saying, Mr. Clancy, we just love your books. And he says, thank you. And then the guy on the phone goes on to say, but you are sure being arrogant with our Diane. At which point Clancy throws his glasses on the table and says, oh, no, we're having a wonderful time, aren't we, Diane? And before I can say a word, the guy on the phone says, sure doesn't sound that way to us, Mr. Clancy. And Clancy was a pussycat for the rest of the hour. And we were asked to have him back on many times. And I said, thank you, but no.
What is your morning like? You have to get up very early and start reading. Do you mind taking us through that a little bit?
I'm up at 5, which, as I've said many times, is the bane of my existence. After I've showered and gotten dressed, first thing I do is take my little dog, Maxie, out for a walk at about 5:45 in the morning, and then come back, fix his breakfast, my breakfast, take a little time. By the time I get to the office, it's about 8:15, 8:30. Staff is ready to discuss with me. There are 5 full-time producers and 3 part-timers. 5 full-time producers and I begin to discuss what is up for the next day. So we're planning 24 hours ahead. One producer takes charge of that. Then I go into my office at 9:15 and start reading for that morning's program. Now, they prepare such wonderful material for me that I truly understand the subject reading for about a half an hour. Then I go downstairs. I record the billboard, the promos, everything I have to do, come back upstairs, do email, go on the air till noon. I do not go out for lunch. I don't like to eat lunch. I don't like to leave the studio until I leave. And so I'm here until about 2:30, go home, do everything else at home, read for second hours at home. Mm-hmm. I like that better.
Diane, after all these years of really being in the heart of things in Washington and covering politics, is it your sense that this presidential election is really, truly unlike anything that we've seen before?
It is the wackiest election I have ever seen. And it really bothers me Chris, and I'll tell you why it bothers me the most. I think the state of dialogue, even the simplest kind of dialogue in this country, is not the best. And it seems to me that these presidential debates have set such a low standard for the kind of political discourse that is truly needed in this country. This country has so many problems, still the finest country in the whole wide world. But we need to do things. We need roadways. We need health care. We need care for the poor. We need education. These issues are not being dealt with, and the manner in which people are talking with each other during these debates has really been discouraging. I fear that the youth of this country are taking those words and those attitudes as examples of how they will or should behave, and that is pretty scary for our country.
Is there anything on your list to read that you can't wait to get to when you don't have anything to prepare for, long form or short form, when there are no deadlines governing your reading?
You know, I may go back to Dostoevsky. I may go back to Somerset Maugham, and I may go back to Alfred North Whitehead. I mean, where it starts, it kind of ends. I'm ready to step away from the microphone. I think it's time for younger ideas, fresher ideas, newer voices. I also think I want to speak out so much about Alzheimer's. And I want to speak out so much about choice in dying. People have labeled me an advocate for the right to die. My advocacy is going to be choice. If you are Roman Catholic or your faith in God is so strong, you say, when God takes me, that's when I go. If you want palliative care forever, good for you, hang in there. If you want to choose to die, that's where I am. And therefore, I am going to advocate for choice.
Diane Rehm's new book is called On My Own. Diane, it has been such an honor to speak with you today. Thank you so much for taking time for us.
And it was a real pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on today's show here at WAMU from Thomas Getter, Chris Whitfield, and Timothy Olmsted. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.